When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a community of people seeking to live our lives in the orienting center of God's love in the midst of our post-Christian world, learning to lead like Jesus, live on mission, and make disciples. In nature, gravity is the phenomenon that brings stuff together, objects as small as atoms and quarks, and as large as stars and galaxies. We believe the gravity of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ. The Gravity Leadership Podcast is curated conversations on what it looks like to practically orient our lives and our leadership in the love of Christ, the gravity that holds everything together.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. My name is Ben Hardman, and we got a special podcast for you guys today because all three of us are actually in the same room.
It's a Festivus miracle.
It's a Festivus for the rest of us. I am here with my co-founders, Matt Tebbe and Ben Sternke.
Hey, guys.
And we are in, where are we? Somewhere in Michigan.
Newaygo, Michigan.
Newaygo.
North of Grand Rapids.
Newaygo, Michigan. It is snowing here.
Yeah, it's winter wonderland out here.
We're busy. We're busy working on our business. We're doing a business retreat.
Yeah.
Doing some strategic planning, trying to get
first time we've ever done anything
right,
like this.
Get our heads straight.
Yep, we're all wearing suits. We've got
very businessy today.
I've got my teal climbing pants on, and I have schmutz all over them. I don't know what it came from. It's like this white.
Well, Ben was bleeding earlier.
You got a nosebleed?
It was a rough business meeting this morning. it went all sorts of wrong.
If you've never done a business meeting, guys, watch out for the blood.
Yeah.
All over your shirt.
There was some weeping.
It was crazy.
There was some weeping.
It was crazy. But in all seriousness, we've done like one day of work with a friend of ours, Jay, who's helping us think through some business processes for our organization.
Can we put his information in the show notes?
Yeah.
Since we're talking about the work he's doing.
That's a great idea. We'll put Jay, his name's Jay Hidalgo. He does coaching and strategy and planning for businesses and stuff like that.
And he loves Jesus.
And he loves Jesus. He's a good man.
He's a good guy.
In many ways. But we just found it really helpful.
He's helped us tremendously today.
We're like three pastors who started an organization that coaches and trains pastors. And like, we love the ministry of that. We love the coaching. We love being in a room with people. We love helping them with that. But we find, we need a lot of help in the organizational elements of kind of running an organization like this. It's been really helpful.
Yeah. We've never claimed to be brilliant at finance or
no
sales.
And we're clearly not.
Yeah, it'd be like if Chrissy Yamaguchi decided to open an ice skating rink. I mean, she knows how to ice skate, but running a rink?
Yeah, there's a lesson there.
It's a that's perfect the whole, metaphor.
Isn't that a great metaphor?
It's really good.
It's the e-myth thing.
Speaking of myths, today we're going to talk about
start with E.
We're going to talk about the Enneagram,
the
greatest myth of them all.
Yes.
Ben Harbin, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, we're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about that today. I'd love to tell you that we're going to be talking about that today.
Yeah.
Among other things.
Well,
we're starting a series, right? Where we're going to spend some time talking about the Enneagram. Ben Sternke, why don't you tell us about it?
I'll say what I know.
I'll say something
and see if it strikes.
Out with it.
So we want to start a little mini series on the Enneagram. there's a lot of podcasts out there that'll teach you about the Enneagram. There's a lot of books and resources and all that kind of stuff. And we do actually do Enneagram workshops. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we get going. But the focus of this podcast.
Why are we doing a series on it? Why are we going to? Why are we going to? Well, I think waste people's time.
Come on, Ben.
So just gave everybody eyes there. Behave, everybody.
Listen, we've been in a room together all day today. Ben's been bleeding.
Yeah.
I've gone to the boys' room several times. And yeah. This has been a...
We've done a lot of work today. We're trying to blow off a little
steam. I
feel
so much closer to you guys today.
I do too. Hmm. This is great.
So we want to talk about it because... And the kind of the topic for this episode is like how the Enneagram can catalyze or further your spiritual formation. Because there's a lot of, I think a lot of the talk of the Enneagram that I've heard lately has either been people just raving about it, like that's the next best thing, like to Jesus, or maybe even better, maybe a little bit better than Jesus, right? Yeah. So people are kind of like going nutso over it, and it's become a popular thing. But then there's also this backlash to it where people are like, wait a second, what's the deal with the Enneagram? And mm-hmm. It's not the gospel, and... You know, we probably shouldn't trust it, and where does it come from, and it's not scientific. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, we actually did a webinar recently where we talked a little bit about how to use the Enneagram like a Christian, but this podcast, I'd love to ask you guys, mm-hmm. And I'll share on this as well, but how, let's be a little bit autobiographical here. So instead of trying to defend the Enneagram, that we can do that if we want, but like, how has it been helpful for your own spiritual formation? Like what are the artifacts of using the Enneagram in your life as it relates to your own formation in Christ-likeness? So not just like, oh, it's a cool personality tool and now people think I'm really great at parties, but like as it relates to you becoming more and more like Christ, how has it been helpful for you?
Yes. Other than the just telling everybody else what their number is and why they're doing that.
Right, right.
It's the most obnoxious thing to do, right?
People love that.
Oh, well, you're just a one.
Oh, that's what a four would say.
Yeah, those things are...
You shut it.
I'm a three. Mm. And
what is a three, Ben?
A three is a performer. And for a long time, I kind of thought I was a one because I have this self-perfection thing that goes in me. And ones tend to lead towards perfection, but my perfection's not for others. It's only for me. And so in that, I've learned a lot about just my desire to be loved by everybody and to be approved by everybody.
Get right
and,
up on that.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah.
That's what we can do when we're in the room together.
That's right.
Push the mic closer to my face.
Get up on that mic, buddy.
Ben Sternke, making things better since 1975.
Yeah. Yes. You have to guess what my Enneagram number is. All right. So you're a three. Go ahead.
So anyway, it's been really helpful for me to learn to resist some of the desire to be upfront. That's actually one of the reasons I'm not on the podcast all the time, is because that's probably the most out front we get. And one of the things I'm learning to do is to not always have to be out front, to not always have to be the one that's performing. It's really redemptive for me to be able to just name the truth that I am approved and that I am loved and that I don't have to perform in order to earn God's approval. Yeah. And that there's people who love me for who I am and not for my ability to perform. So that's been one way that's been really helpful for me of just kind of trying to start some habits in my life that avoid being upfront and avoid being in the stage or the center of attention. And then being able to name when I feel like I am performing. Like, you know, you walk into a room and you kind of see what the room wants you to be and you just step into that role. Being able to name some of that stuff has been really helpful. But I think the greatest benefit for me has been relationship with my wife and understanding she's a one.
Okay.
And so we're both perfectionists, but we're both perfectionists in different ways. So like the worst scenario we could ever have together is IKEA furniture.
Because, like trying to put it together.
Yeah, okay. Because she wants to follow, like we have to follow every step perfectly. Like whatever. And
sure.
No, you don't.
I haven't even looked at the directions. I've got it half put together. And it's wrong, like but I'll figure it out later. Sure. But she doesn't want me to do it wrong.
Yes.
We have to follow every step. And so she's a rule follower and mm-hmm. wants to follow every step.
Yes.
And wants to do things perfectly. So mm-hmm. there's a specific way to unload the dishes. There's a specific way to make the bed. Those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And for me, I just want people to think that it's done well. I don't need to actually do it right. I just need others to think that I'm doing it right.
Somebody walks into the room and thinks, oh, that's a chair. Then my work is done.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, I'm doing fine.
Yeah.
That's great. So I hear you naming, Hardman, a couple things. One is that the Enneagram helped you to name not just sort of some external behaviors, but some deeper motivations that were present in your life, but having the Enneagram as a lens allowed light to shine into that place in your heart to be like, oh gosh, there is a tendency here. I like the spotlight. Yeah. And then to kind of pause and examine that with Christ.
Yep.
To Absolutely. Say, why do I like that so much? And then also kind of some, the other thing I heard you say was there's some understanding of others. Like you mentioned Sarah, your wife. And so there's a ability to kind of perceive that not everybody comes from the same place as me. And there's a different motivation, different kind of underlying desires going on in other people.
Yeah, it oftentimes I think it names your mask. Like it mm. names what you're hiding behind. And that's been really helpful for me. And it's been, you know, for me, I think the journey of being a three and of trying to figure out what's healthy ambition and what's selfish ambition and when right. am I being real and when am I being what people want me to be, that's been a lifelong struggle and trying to figure those things out. And so it's been really helpful to help me name some of that stuff and even to give me some language to talk about it.
Yeah.
And then also for my wife and I, for us to have loads of compassion for one another, for where we're at. And so she's picked up on, you know, kind of some of these things because the Enneagram's given me some language to talk to her about it that's going on in me. And so she's often just saying to me, like, I love you no matter what you did today. Like you don't have
yeah.
to,
yeah.
you didn't have to clean the whole house and preach a great sermon Sunday and, yeah. and do yeah. all of these things in order to earn my love today. I love you cause you're you. And that's
yeah.
good.
Yep. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
The other thing I'm noticing too, Ben, is that many of us can go through our whole lives in churches, church leadership, church cultures, being rewarded for our mask.
Yeah.
That's right.
So
that's what people like about you.
Right. So
church planning is for threes and eights.
So platform, right? Like platform
that's
Ben,
what we're looking for,
platform
right?
Ben is yeah. like your, is like your crack, right? Yeah. And so like, yeah. it like feeds your ego, feeds the mask, but it's also what the people adore. And you have yeah. to give the people what they want, you know? Yeah. And so there's this like,
kind of reinforced internally and externally. It's
yeah.
it's hard to get out of the trap. And the Enneagram is a really, really helpful and effective way of being able to see the trap, see the mask, go, oh, yeah. this isn't me. This is the mask I wear to kind of get through life. This yeah. is the thing I've learned to do to kind of get my needs met. That the Enneagram, I think, helps us uncover those things because there's at least 9 different ways of sort of wearing a mask to get your needs met.
Yeah. So... Yeah. So your church is like Dance Monkey, and you're like, absolutely, I'd
sure,
love to dance
sure.
for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just
yeah.
creates a codependency.
Will you love me if I dance?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah, if you love me more, of course I'll dance.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd love to do
yeah.
that.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that's really good. Mm. How about you, Matt?
How about you, Ben?
Oh. Well.
I would share my number with you, but you wouldn't understand.
You wouldn't understand, yeah.
No,
plus he's not like the other fours.
I'm an Enneagram 4.
What does that mean?
It means the Enneagram 4 is an individualist, and so they like to stand out. They like to be special. They like to be noticed. They like to be seen. And the underlying need for a 4 is to actually be seen, you know, mm-hmm. to see me as I really am. So 4s always feel like they have to create an identity mm-hmm. so that they can be acknowledged and noticed. And that often comes out in like eccentric dress or being special. A lot of artists are 4s. Yeah. A lot of
worship leaders.
Well, yeah.
It can mm-hmm. be.
If the skinny
jeans.
If the skinny jeans fit. Mm-hmm. So for me then, I think, man, you know, the Enneagram has wings. We'll probably get into this in my early life. I discovered an identity. I found my place in life by being a performer. Mm-hmm. So I remember I grew up in a middle school, grade school, that valued athletics, and I was always like a B minus athlete. Like I would be just bad enough not to make the A team, and then I'd make the B team and like pout because I wasn't on the A team. And this guy came to our middle school when I was in junior high, and he put on a musical, and I auditioned and I got the lead role. And like the first time of my life, all these jocks and their dads were like, "You're good. You're really good." Mm. And it like for the first time in my life, all the people that I wanted to see me were actually seeing me. Mm. And so I just leaned into performing and being on stage, and I was really good at it, but it was always like this tragic fear that I wouldn't be good enough at it. Yeah. And so then being a four has been learning how to not get away from the stage, not get away from crafting an identity, but learning how God's redeeming that.
Mm. Yeah. I think the other thing that's interesting to me is bringing it up, this up as you talk, is there's these subtle nuances, because those three and four sound similar in some ways.
Yeah.
Where you're like, okay, well, you know, you guys are both wanting others to see you. But for a three, it's a little bit more, the desire to be admired.
Esteemed.
Then, yeah.
Respected.
Yeah. Respected, admired.
Competent.
But then for the four, it's a little bit more like, do you see me as I really am? You know, which is more of a, it's just got a nuance to it, right?
Yeah. So four, then the question that haunts a four is, who am I? Mm. And if you can see me, then I might have an identity.
Yeah.
You know?
Because the deep fear is I actually don't.
I don't have an identity.
I don't have any significance, personal significance.
Nope. Yeah.
There's not special.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so fours often walk through life with this chronic aching sense that they're more broken, more wounded, more sinful than anybody. Yeah. So fours tend towards being self-condemning, morose, you know, self-pitying, all the wonderful attributes that we really value in people. It's actually a really healthy thing for a four to reckon with the fact that they're not as bad as they think they are.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just say this too, like a lot of us grew up in religious traditions, especially in conservative Protestant evangelical places, where the consistent haranguing message about your humanity is you're awful.
Yeah.
Like before God, you are a worm and you're dirt and you're nothing.
Right. And like, that's like the righteous way to talk about yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And parenthetically, if you're an Enneagram 8, that's the kind of self-messaging you need to remind yourself that you actually have flaws.
Right.
Right? Yeah. So here's my hypothesis real quick. That kind of dominant American conservative Christianity was developed by Enneagram 8s who had to live in that space or else they would be complete egotistical narcissists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But for the rest of us, especially fours, it just reinforces self-condemnation and self-hatred.
Right. It doesn't help you out of sin. It reinforces the way you're in it.
Right. So let me be really clear. I don't preach or practice that kind of gospel message. I mean, I think actually we're created with dignity and worth and value.
Sure.
This is what it means to be created in the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
And even if we are flawed, broken, sick, apart from Christ, there's still inherent worth and dignity in us.
Yeah.
So we're not worms. We're not filthy rags.
It's not an identity.
No.
Yeah. Anytime I think that kind of message floats into the identity category, it starts to become bad news,
right.
Not good news.
But I sat with an Enneagram 8 recently, and I told this person, hey, you've sinned against me in X, Y, and Z ways, and it was completely incomprehensible to them that I could be right.
Right.
All 8s are like this. I've got really healthy 8s in my life. But an unhealthy 8 assumes they're never wrong. Yeah. And so I'm just saying, like, what's a healing thought for an 8? I may be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I can't trust my motivations is a damning thought for a four,
because
a four lives in that prison all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is why I think the Enneagram's helpful, is because the fact that Jesus is Lord is this cosmic, global, meta, beautiful message that tethers to our actual life in really particular, concrete ways.
Mm.
And so each of us actually needs a really, itemized, particularized, specific word of good news, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That actually, there isn't a one-size-fits-all abstracted gospel. Yes.
Yeah, which is a huge, I think part of the reason this resonates so much for us is this is a huge part of our training. So Gravity Leadership Academy, one of the main things you learn how to do, both in year one and year two, is you learn how to proclaim these messages of good news into particular and concrete contexts, right? Where it's like the gospel message isn't something that I memorize and then rehearse and repeat. The gospel message is something that I learn to inhabit so that I can proclaim it to you right where you're at as I perceive where you're at.
Yeah.
So I'm like you were saying, Ben, earlier about Sarah speaking the words of good news to you.
Yes.
That are based on what she knows about you from looking at you through the lens of the Enneagram. Like he needs to know that he's affirmed and loved, even if he had a bad day, even if the sermon was, know.
So
even if.
So, you know. So let me say this. So then the Enneagram then helps us understand where does the bad news most have purchase in our life.
Yeah.
So I need esteem too.
Yep.
Right. Right. Just because I'm
something
a four.
We all do.
Yeah. We all need esteem. Yeah. Right. And I think Ben, you're a one. You'll talk about that in a second. But we all want to make things good and better and right.
Yeah. That's good.
But for me, my body isn't ready to believe that my identity is tied to my performance the way it is for you, Ben. Mm-hmm. And your body isn't ready to believe that I don't really exist unless you can see me the way that is for me. So it's not like I'm not tempted towards the thing that you are. It's just that this is the epicenter of like all death, destruction, and all his satanic friends in my life. This is the foothold, the stronghold.
Yeah, it's the stronghold. Yeah, it's where the bad news can take root.
Yeah. And so the Enneagram gives you language and a lens and then vision.
And self-awareness, right?
And self-awareness for how to move through that. So then the healing thing for a four isn't to like deny your fourness or to, you know, to be anti-four. Yeah. No, there's a maturity into it. I mean, there's beautiful things. There are beautiful things that an Enneagram four can offer the world.
Yes.
One of them is like equanimity, emotional balance.
Yeah.
Right? One of them is creative, artistic.
Yeah. You know, ability to touch sort of the pathos of the world and show it to us.
Yeah.
Help us see it. Yeah, help us see what you see. Yeah. You know what I mean? That's a gift.
Yeah. Yeah.
Another gift I have to offer is sarcastic jokes that grow on you. And so there's...
Over time.
Yeah. So anyway, the Enneagram then isn't a static tool that puts you in a box that then you have to figure your way out of. But it gives you a journey. It gives you a pathway of maturity and healing and holiness.
Yeah, totally. That's one of the things that I wanted to highlight about it is I think that so much, especially for me as an Enneagram one, so much of my assumptions about spiritual growth and transformation were rooted in, so an Enneagram one is they're called a perfectionist or a reformer, and they kind of have this justice, righteousness kind of bone in their body where they're wanting to, they want to see justice done. They want to see what's right happen in the world. But that can oftentimes devolve into sort of a self-righteousness and a critiquing of everything that they
like
perceive
as wrong.
Like a critical
spirit.
Yeah, critical, judgmental. That's kind of what a one can devolve into. But one of the most helpful things is I used to kind of think of spiritual formation as stop being bad.
Yeah.
Which is, that's kind of a one's mantra.
Yeah.
Right? Everybody stop being bad, including me.
Just follow the rules.
Yeah, follow the rules. Stop being bad, including me. Even though I'm a little bit like, I've sometimes had an interesting relationship with the rules because a lot of times ones are rule followers.
Older brothers, right?
Yeah, they can be older brothers. But I have had a little bit of a different, I feel like if the rules make sense to me, I'm happy to follow them. But if they don't make sense, like I will be the first to break them because I don't think they make sense. So that's probably the critical thing though coming out. It's like these rules suck. I'm going to make up some new ones.
My rules are better than
my
yours.
Rules are better than these.
Yeah, you've made some rules, but my rules are going
to
be.
Yeah, my rules are the ones that we really need to be doing. Anyway, but I used to have this vision that spiritual formation for me was stop being bad like that.
Yeah.
But the Enneagram has given a vision for moving through. One of the ways Richard Rohr talks about it is moving through your sin to find this virtue on the other side of it, where you can't become holy by avoiding your sin, by going around it, by backing away from it, by just trying to stop doing these activities of sin. And so one of the ways that the Enneagram has been really helpful is that it doesn't just name the activity of sin. It doesn't just say, hey, sometimes you're really critical, you should stop being
knock
critical,
it off.
Right?
Knock it off.
Where my vision of that has been, okay, I'm going to notice what's wrong, but then I shouldn't say anything. But that doesn't help me. No. You know what I mean? Like overall, because I'm still, there's still this impulse, right? This desire to point it out. Well, and I have to examine that.
But even the impulse, yeah, even the impulse to self-correct yourself.
Right. That's even part of it.
Is your critic criticizing your critic?
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. It's a second critic.
You know those finger...
I'm being way too critical. I can't believe that I'm being so critical.
It's meta. It's like one of those finger traps. You put your fingers in and you try to pull them out. It gets them stuck even worse.
Totally. Yeah. So the one of the things that's been so helpful has been realizing, no, the way through is to confront the reality of it and name it and be present to it and to realize that there is a gift on the other side of this. I don't become something other than a one. I move into my virtue. I move into my gift.
What is your virtue?
Well, I think it's traditionally named serenity, but what it refers to is the ability to accept the world just as it is.
Yeah, you know,
it's a big discipline for me.
When you think of that, I think of George Costanza's dad, who would scream "Serenity now!"
Serenity now!
Did he have
right? He had some Enneagram one streak.
Mm-hmm. He was Festivus for the rest of us.
Yeah, we're back to Festivus. No, but that's been a really helpful thing for me to realize. Okay, there is a gift on the other side of this that ones can be wise. They can be discerning. Mm. They can see the way through, but the way through is not to just repress my critic. The way through is to realize that, like, there's a reason that I want to be critical, but like, I can drop this. Like, I can drop this, and I can accept that this person is just as they are right here.
And also knowing that critique is needed. Like, we actually need you. Like,
right.
All critique is not bad.
Right. Seeing what's wrong isn't necessarily bad.
Yeah.
Right.
It's just we need leaders that can define the problem and define what's wrong and define what's going
but
on.
The freedom for me has been realizing I can see what's wrong, but also just accept that it's there and also then exercise the discernment and the wisdom to know, do I need to say something about this? Yep. And I'm also free to say nothing. Yeah. I'm free to do both.
Yeah, it's good.
Like that's the
I think the Enneagram's helped, like it helps me with ambition, right? Because all ambition isn't wrong, but oftentimes the way that I pursue ambition is wrong, right? Yeah. So the same thing, all critique is not wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
But there has to be a measure of balance and understanding and discernment within the midst of that.
So you guys are talking about something that's really important, I think the Enneagram does for us, which is in Christian circles that I grew up in, typically when you talked about sin, it was like, don't gamble, don't have adultery, don't
listen to music backwards.
Don't listen to
specific sins.
Don't listen to the raps, you know, and
or the heavy metal.
Or the heavy metal. You know, and what the Enneagram does is it says your core motivation that leads you into the worst of sin is actually a good motivation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the temptations that grab us aren't the worst ideas to ruin our lives. It's the best ideas to bring us, quote, life.
Right.
And those best ideas to bring us life actually trap us in sin and brokenness.
Right. Because we're seeking goodness apart from receiving it from God. Yeah. We're trying to achieve it for ourselves. Yeah.
And this is the predicament of most of us who aren't masochists and psychopaths.
Yeah. People don't sin because they're like, how could I hurt someone?
The most people.
You know, they don't wake up thinking like, I'd really love to hurt my kids today. I'll think I'll yell at them. Mm-hmm. I'll find something to yell. No. There's something else. So to use my kids as an example, like for me as an Enneagram 1, anytime I got into hurting my kids by raising my voice, ultimately what I was doing, I realized, what am I trying to do? I'm seeking righteousness, right? I want them to like do well and do good in life. You know what I mean? Like, but because I wasn't able to sort of receive that from the Lord and accept them as they are and kind of work with them, because I was seeking it in my own strength, you know, I end up sort of doubling down and trying to coerce.
Like being pressure, like putting pressure on
Putting pressure on them to be righteous. Even though, like, you know, it's a good motivation to seek. Unrighteousness sucks. It's terrible. You know what I mean? Like, wickedness is awful.
That
should
be the name
world.
Of the podcast today. Unrighteousness sucks.
Unrighteousness sucks. It's ruining the world.
Yeah. 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 My son is a one. He's 11. Mm. And we were on this conference call yesterday, or 2 days ago for our church, where we're hosting and sponsoring some refugees that are coming into the country. Yeah. They need host homes because adults also sleep in cages.
Yeah.
I just learned this.
Yeah.
Not just the kids.
And the ones we're hosting are coming from Africa. They reroute them to these detention centers on the southern border.
In Texas.
So there's like,
Anyway, so there's two families that are hosting them. We're on this call, and Deacon cares passionately about this, wishes we could host them, but We're not going to... anyway, it's a long story. So anyway, somebody on the call is like, hey, Deacon, do you have a thought for the day for us? And he was like, oh, you know, putting the love
in... He took it so seriously. He did. He was, as one would.
He was thinking about it, and he gave 30 seconds of thinking. And I was really proud of our community that I let him think. And then somebody's like, well, you don't have to answer. And Deacon's like, I'll tell you later. So later, this is what he said. This is an Enneagram one.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, not everything is black and white, Dad. Even if you want things to be black and white, most of reality isn't black and white. And like, that's a healing thought for an 11-year-old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because Enneagram one, yes.
And for an,
both, yes.
You know, so he's like,
that's great.
He's like reflecting on what he's learning.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, for me as a four who actually never knows what they want, I'm like, I wish things were black and white more.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It might be healing for me.
Might be good news.
It might be good news for me to be more black and white.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that gives a little bit of like flesh to like what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, we want to talk about the Enneagram more.
Yeah.
And how it can function in giving us vision and language for our progression in holiness.
Yeah. Totally.
Growing into maturity into Christ-likeness.
Yeah. Yeah. And in effect, like, it's not, I mean, man, it just, I'm thinking of so many things that happened to me recently where, like, part of the reason I think I had the self-awareness to realize what was going on is because of the Enneagram.
Yeah. Like,
well, like, Enneagram ones tend to take responsibility. And one of the things I've been realizing lately about just the way I navigate my life is that I have, the way that I've found my way into, like, can I be here? Do you like me? Do you want me around? Is I've realized that it has to do with my competence. So I've thought that I have to bring some level of, I have to have something of value to offer.
To demonstrate competence in order to be esteemed.
In order to be here, yeah. Right? And so I was talking, so this manifests itself with my kids who are mostly older now. I've got a 22-year-old, a 19-year-old, a 15-year-old, no, she's 16 now, 16-year-old and a 14-year-old. And so the way that I used to sort of be of value to them, I still am their dad, but like as their dad, I would like teach them lessons and, you know,
wipe their bottom.
Yeah, right. That would be something I would do too. But I found my sort of value in the sense that dad has some wise things to say
and he has
some good advice. Right. But now as my kids are getting older and I'm learning more about, you know, who I am and that kind of thing, I'm actually finding it, I find it deeply frustrating if I either don't have anything to offer them or they don't want it, right? If they don't want dad's advice, it's like, I feel this immediate, I mean, we
like
sort of
thwarting,
joke around.
Like you feel like a thwarted.
Yeah, like, wait, like you're thwarting my whole schema for how I'm valuable here.
Which most teenagers love their dad's advice, right?
I know, I don't know what's wrong with my kids.
it's so weird.
No, but the redemptive thing in it is that they know this about me, and so we can joke about it. But it's been an interesting thing to just recognize that when I launch into my immediate thought, oftentimes is to launch into advice, or like here's a word of wisdom, or maybe think about this instead of this, right? So my immediate sort of impulse is to do that, and then when it's rejected or it doesn't seem to be what actually will help them, there's this immediate shame that comes over me where I'm like, well, what good am I? Why am I even here? Like, I literally want to leave the room if that happens. And so I've started to learn to just examine that and go like, why do I want to leave here? Okay, it's because I don't feel valuable, but I'm learning like my presence is value like for them, and learning to just be there and accept where they're at and accept that I maybe don't have anything to say to you like right now. Maybe I don't have any good advice. Apparently I don't, because you won't take it. But I'm learning to say, like, that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you.
Yeah.
It just means that, okay, I don't have what I need in this situation, but maybe my presence is enough here.
Ben, I think I just had a breakthrough in my marriage.
Oh, wow. Because
my wife is a one.
Oh.
And
Sharon, if you're listening.
And when I often share things that perplex me, by the way, about 89 times a day, I'm perplexed.
I've never noticed
that. What is going on?
I've never noticed that.
I'm in a tsunami of perplexion most of the time.
Okay. So when you share things that perplex you.
That's another good title for this podcast.
So,
tsunami of perplexion.
So my wife tends to assume that she needs, that what I need from her is for her to, you know, maybe this
fix
is.
Fix it.
Yeah. Like, yeah. bring some solution or competence to my problem.
Yeah.
And I end up telling her in very calm, kind ways.
I just need you to hold me.
You shut your mouth when you're talking to me. No, I just need you to hear me and thank me for sharing. I mean, this has been, we've been married 20 years almost, and so it's a journey. But anyway, honey, if you're listening, I love you. But there's a sense in which I'm noticing, like, it's so helpful for me to be aware of what my wife's needs are when I'm not getting my needs met.
Yes.
Come on.
In marriage, right?
Right.
So if I'm not getting my needs met, there's like this four-year-old that's like throwing a tantrum.
Right.
You know, taking the mashed potatoes and throwing them on the wall and like rubbing his dirty bottom on the, you know what I mean? I'm just like flipping out.
Metaphorically. Or maybe sometimes literally?
No, I don't do that really at home.
Yeah, I haven't seen, I've been to your dinner table. I haven't seen that one yet.
No. The police were really clear. You will not do this again, sir.
This will
sir.
Never happen.
No, so there's a little boy in me that's demanding my needs get met. Mm. But what the Enneagram does on my best days is it gives me lenses to see that my wife has needs too.
Yeah.
And she's not being insensitive or a jerk.
Right.
Or disconnected. Yeah. She's simply doing the best she can with her frame of reality.
Yeah.
And like, I think this is one of the things that has helped me have compassion more than anything is just to realize not everybody sees the world like me.
Yeah.
And everybody has the same concern I do, which is, am I okay? Am I going to be okay?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And because we've all got different strategies for being okay, those sometimes butt up against each other.
Yeah,
we don't have the same impulses. And I would say that, I'm glad you brought that up. I think that's one of the most helpful things for our marriage. So for my wife and I.
You just referenced you and I.
Oh, well, I didn't mean to, but there is a lot of joking about our marriage, ministry marriage. My marriage to my wife, Deb.
Thank you.
Good
clarification.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. In that scenario, I'm the one, right? And so I'm typically the fixer. And so Deb is usually the one sharing how work was really hard today and this person yelled at me and whatever else she's sharing. But I recognize my immediate impulse is to fix it or help her feel better.
Yeah.
Like, well, you know, let me tell you something that'll help you feel better or give you a new way to think about it, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And she has to remind me a lot. Like, I just need you to hear me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not looking for anything else, but, like, that sounds hard.
Yeah.
And so, oftentimes, I come back to that. I'm like, okay, what does she need here in this moment? Because not the things that feel obvious to me aren't obvious to her, and the things that are obvious to her don't feel obvious to me.
Yeah, one of the strategies we have with our son, who knows he's a one because he read an Enneagram book at like age six to figure...
Which is what an Enneagram does. Enneagram one does.
To figure out who he is. Yeah. Anyway, so he's got this critic, right, where his 7-year-old sister will like draw a picture and he'll be like, the perspective's all messed up on that. That's not 3D at all, you know what I mean? Like, and so we've named like his critic, we've named him Steve.
Yeah.
And we're just like...
Brilliant.
We just make jokes about it.
Yeah.
I'm like, hey, buddy, tell Steve he can take a break.
Yeah.
Tell Steve to go watch an episode of, Bunked.
Right.
Right? And then he kind of laughs, but we're able to talk about the critic without him feeling like shame and pressure to criticize the critic.
Yes.
Yes.
Like, so we just joke about
the
critic.
It's huge. Yes.
As a way to detach him from the need to satisfy that inner voice.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's a brilliant strategy. Like, I think in two ways. One, the humor. Like, I've been learning that any time I can bring humor, like when I can get all of us laughing about this, like it's always better. 100% of the time, if we can laugh, it's better.
We can figure it out.
Right, because we're out of our, I mean, to use neurology language, we're out of our amygdalas and our fight or flight, and we're into our prefrontal cortex, and we can kind of get a perspective on it. And that's the other thing I think that's brilliant about naming the inner critic is that Deacon gets some, that's your son, he gets some distance from that voice in his head, and it's not him, so there's no shame attached to it.
Yeah.
It's Steve's fault. It's Steve doing this.
Yeah.
It's not, you're such a bad kid.
Yeah.
You know, it's more like, hey, let's tell Steve to take a break. He's different than, like, your inner critic is not you.
The only way,
super helpful.
The only way for the inner critic to get healed for you and for my son
is
for there to be some compassion and gentleness towards him.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes, and this is
for you to learn to treat yourself the way Christ does.
Yes,
is what we're saying. Yeah. This is deeply theological work.
It is.
It is. It is. It's helpful.
Yeah. So it's not just this pop psychology kind of thing that is like, where did this come from? I mean, you can use it that way. I don't think it's very helpful if you use it that way.
Yeah, it's all the kids that are like, well, you're just an eight, you know. It's that kind
of... Right, dismissing people on the basis of it. Right, or dismissing their own actions on basis of it. But I think that the way that it's been helpful is if you do use it as a Christian theological tool, I think it actually works really well.
Yeah.
And maybe end the episode just with this anecdote that... naming the inner critic reminded me of my wife was talking about this. So my wife is a six, Enneagram six, and it's the need to I can't think of it right now.
The loyalist.
The loyalist. Yeah, yeah, they're extremely loyal.
They have a need for safety and security.
Yeah, the need to be secure, the need to be safe. So Deb has recognized, my wife has recognized, that there's a lot of just anxiety about like, is everything going to be okay, right? That kind of thing. And we were listening to some dog training videos. We got this new little dog. She's two and a half. We've had her two and a half years. She's part of the family, but she still feels new
she's
sometimes.
Still new.
Yeah, but she's this tiny little thing, and she's a little bit high strung, you know, as dogs go.
Yeah,
where like anybody who comes to the door, anybody who walks past the house is a potential threat.
Yeah.
And so she'll start barking.
Edith is her name.
Edith is her name, yeah.
Edith really loves me.
Yeah. Well, she loves every stranger. I'd hate to burst your bubble.
No, it's
she
just
loves
me.
Every stranger.
It's,
yeah.
It's just me.
Enneagram 3 wants Edith to especially love me.
Yeah, it's just me. Yeah. It's mostly me.
But anyway, so she'll
mostly
bark.
Mostly me.
Yeah. And so we used to get super frustrated at her, and I still do sometimes. And sort of, you know, she'd be like, stop barking. Yeah, like, cut it out. Everything's fine. You know, like getting angry with her.
Yeah, yeah.
And this dog trainer was saying, like, actually, she thinks you're like affirming the fact that we should all be very afraid right now because you're barking too, in essence. And so the dog trainer said, all you do is you walk into the room and you say, thank you. And then you walk out of the room. And basically what you're doing is thanking the dog for trying to protect the pack.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Thank you, but I'm not worried and everything's going to be okay.
And you're going to be okay.
I don't think that'll work, Ben. I'm going to be...
Working.
Is it working?
Yeah.
It is working.
Is she it
is
really?
She's calming down. Just thank you. And here's the point of all
Can
this.
Can you come over and talk to Jimmy? Jimmy,
by the way, Jimmy is still available in case.
Yeah,
Jimmy. We've offered him before on the podcast.
He had his seventh birthday yesterday.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah, he's
happy
a terrible,
birthday, Jimmy.
Terrible dog.
You had a point to make though, so about
the
Edith
point. The point
heard.
Yeah. So to make sure we connect all this, so Deb had this realization where she realized, oh, that little voice that's always warning me about what could go wrong is Edith.
Oh man,
it's Edith barking.
Hmm.
And so she's learning, it's beautiful to hear her talk about this, but she's learning, we should get her on the podcast, but she's learning to have some compassion for
thank
that
you.
And say thank you to her fear. Yeah. Basically say like, thank you, I know you're trying to keep me safe, but we don't need to obsess about that right now.
That's beautiful.
You can stop barking.
That's beautiful.
You know what I mean? Isn't that great?
Mm. Yeah.
So that's, well, I mean, that's another, I mean, that's how it's affecting her spiritual formation.
It's,
which is
it's
great.
The ability to take a look at your life and be honest without any attachment to, is this right or wrong?
Yeah.
Like that kind of,
yeah.
There's no attachment to value in it.
Yeah, yeah.
This is what is, and there's value in just naming it as what it is and knowing that God is with you in it and God's grace is available to you.
It corresponds to our
axiom.
I still
don't think that works
that's
with
right.
dogs, but, well, but I appreciate that story.
It's working with Edith.
The most important information about Edith these days.
I try and kick Jimmy. What he does it. Is that,
if you,
is that what you're supposed
podcast,
to do?
If you work for the ASPCA, please.
The police made it clear.
Edith has a new boyfriend. Is that right?
Dude, oh my gosh. So this doesn't have anything to do with the Enneagram, but it's the cutest thing in the world. So Edith does not like other dogs in general. She's just afraid of them. She's like, I don't have time for you. I'm a human. I think she thinks she's a human. So she loves other humans.
Yeah, when she does. When I come over there, she's a big fan.
She loves other humans. Other dogs, she's like either terrified or she's like, what? Like what?
Yeah.
Why are you talking to me?
Yeah,
like what's going on?
Yeah.
But there is this little dog named Edmund who is
Edmund
about her size.
Edith.
Edmund and Edith. And Edmund is about 9 months old and Edmund goes for walks in the same neighborhood. And like a few weeks ago, Edith started like whine. Every time she sees Edmund, she starts whining. And if she's on a leash, she just runs toward Edmund.
Yeah.
And they have this little sort of
Momo
flirtatious,
as
I'm interpreting it as flirtatious, kind of playful, like they play with each other and they really want to sort of, and so if Edmund walks by and Edith is in the house, we just hear her whining and we're like, oh, Edmund's walking
Edmund's
by.
Outside. So Edith, it's like a couple from Downton Abbey. Yeah. Edmund and Edith. Edmund,
yeah, right? They're courting right now.
Yeah.
And once their parents give them permission, I think they'll marry on the morrow. And anyway.
Yeah.
So she's got a boyfriend.
That's really sweet.
Yeah, be careful.
It is pretty sweet.
Teenage girls.
Yeah, look out.
In dog years.
She is, she's like 18 in dog years.
Yeah, 18 in dog years. She's ready, to hook up.
Lock that, lock that down.
This has gone terribly wrong.
This is... Welcome to Dog Love Chat.
Oh, man. How did this...
Anyway. So we're beginning a series on the Enneagram.
Yeah.
And this is why we're talking about it, because of how... transformational and important it's been for us, and how it points us towards Christ and the gospel, rather than becomes the gospel or becomes this category or label or box we put people in.
Totally,
it's good.
And because of that, we do these Enneagram workshops that we'll put a link in the show notes. But if you're interested in hosting a workshop, kind of come bringing us out to talk, we talk through the Enneagram, we teach through it. And then we have a series of exercises that allow you to develop a spiritual transformation experiment.
Yes.
Based on your number, that just is like, here's some things I'm going to try this week, maybe this month, maybe this year, some new practices that will help me lean into the good news that God wants to speak over me specifically in my number. So
it's really fun.
It is. It's they're really fun workshops.
Yeah, they're always fun.
We have a great time. There's a lot of humor. It's fun.
So do we know who's going to be? We have some big guests lined up for this.
Yeah. Well, AJ Sherrill, who does these kinds of workshops as well, who's a pastor in Grand Rapids.
Chuck DeGroat,
who's also in the Grand Rapids area.
Michigan.
Ooh, Grand Rapids. Interesting.
Barack Obama. Is he coming?
He's going to come on and talk about his type. Theorize about how.
Werner Herzog.
Filmmaker.
The famous German film. So anyway, stay tuned.
Wayne Gretzky. Right.
Some of those people will be on the podcast.
Stefan Mayberry, who's still in China. Anyway.
He's coaching now.
We're going to go have fun. We're going to go we're going to grab some dinner.
We're going to grab some dinner. This is our life right now. And we're excited to bring this series.
Yeah.
Feel free to hit us up at podcast@gravityleadership.com if you have ideas or questions specifically about the Enneagram.
Yeah.
We're excited to bring this series to you. And hope you have a really nice day.
See you next week.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you enjoy learning from this podcast, please be sure to show your support by rating, reviewing, and subscribing on iTunes. Be sure to share with your friends on social media too. And we would love to hear from you. So please email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. You can join our online community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.